This podcast brought to you by the English Department at Florida State University.
Hi. Is that okay? I am honored to introduce a poet I've been excited about since beginning the program. It's a rare privilege for any workshop writer to take home poems from another student so advanced in her craft, so deft at getting your attention. And it's rare that I would feel so at home inside them as I would a Sylvia Plath poem, a Lin-Manuel poem, an Anne Carson poem, or even a Diane Arbus photo. During my workshop with Paige Lewis, I found in her poems templates and markers for composing the poems I'd been hesitant to let out of myself. I found the Paige poem like a wooded trail leading me to a secluded spot perfect for building one's own cottage. I've made friends with a lady who thought parts of her were dead and who could talk to the earthworms feeding on them. In another poem, a woman had it bad for the local butcher daydreamed about his bloody apron. Side note, Paige is a vegetarian. I listened to a lonely girl suffering from psychosis who thought the refrigerator, the couch, and the toaster were verbally attacking her. With each line, I could feel her apartment shrinking around me like a tyrant who seems to be increasingly everywhere. Like I said, I felt right at home. I read an instruction manual for how to deal with a machine in a box that is actually a woman. Paige has a gift for stretching her range of voices, from ones that appear defeated to ones that unapologetically claim a self, a gift that takes most poets much longer to develop. Part of what makes us listen is that, defeated or not, all of these voices know themselves. Paige is not at all psychotic, but she knows how to confront the tyrant in fear, rational and irrational. After all, aren't many fears we obsess over irrational? Most of us don't sleep in caves anymore and are free of the panther lurking near the campfire. And if we were cavemen, wouldn't the fear of the panther's ambush often be more painful, more recurring than the ambush? I think poetry exists primarily to deal with this crack in our consciousness. Mary Ruffel, who resists the classroom discussion of poetic theme, says, "In my lifetime, I have believed that poetry from all periods and all cultures, has had only one theme, that of mutability." Not unrelated to this idea or Paige's poetry is Ruffel's belief that she became a writer because in the fifth grade she and a classmate had a pencil fight during which a piece of graphite became lodged in her hand forever. Bizarrely enough, Paige also got into a pencil fight in fifth grade with Nico Troya, an Argentinian boy she had a crush on. And like Ruffel, you can still see the small piece of graphite beneath the skin of her left thumb knuckle. If poets are obsessed with mutability and the tension between chaos and order, it is often anxiety for the self. Paige extends that anxiety for people and to creatures outside herself, beings often so vulnerable they're near powerless. One of her personas finds trouble steadying her gaze, can't see an accident until there's blood in the batter. And as she stumbles upon something even more vulnerable, she immediately mourns his loss. She says, "I have seen the wings of a cutthroat finch wavering around its body, stuck, burned to the grill of my car, which means I have failed to notice its flight, a lesson on infinities, a lesson I am trying to learn." Here Paige cleverly uses visual impairment as a way of illuminating a problem in which our preoccupation with finalities can overpower our ability to find satisfaction in finite joys along the way. Paige also illuminates the tragic consequences of our recklessness, how something we perceive as simple as paving a road through a bird's habitat often leads to periods of mourning from a poet sensitive enough to notice. In any Paige poem, there's confound confusion at work. A questioning, an indictment even, of a world that allows both flight and its fall, allows such beauty to be spoiled by crude power, allows birth and sudden death. Why can't a finch keep flying, living, until it's ready to stop? Why is there always a bigger bird perching on a lookout? There are many reasonable answers to this confusion, but the page poem is ahead of them. If survival is the name of the game in this universe, and if survival must be awarded to the most powerful, the page poem dares to ask, why survive? Why keep struggling to win out over the less powerful if we have to hurt them? This is what the best art does. The page poem challenges our convenient philosophies, the basic rules they've imposed on us and the natural world, and says, not so fast. Look closely at the finch. Look closely at the cat that has given birth to smaller cats. The page poem asks how long you'll keep those smaller cats hidden. Quote, before your father grabs a sack and walks to the river between purple jacarandas. Only a poet preoccupied with these tragedies in real life could write such heartbreaking lines. During a coffee date not long ago, Paige carried a baby skink away from the door to save her from our feet. Everyone close to Paige has witnessed similar interventions. A ladybug with missing legs who would meet certain death in a sink. For a lizard, an ant, a spider, and many others. When Paige was a kid, she refused to use her Lisa Frank animal stickers because that would obviously hurt the animals. And it makes sense. You take the pink leopard out of the environment specifically shaped for him. You put him where he wasn't designed to be. And what if his new home ends up in the landfill with all the other papers? Like everything vulnerable, such creatures cannot endure in the universe we insist on building. And many of the animals our rescuer has found too late now have a permanent place in her poems. And if their beauty, so painfully elegized, still spins somewhere in the dark matter, I'm sure they're grateful. All of us who are handicapped in some form are also grateful. And now for a little fun. Some of her fans at FSU have already contributed to her praise page. One of her biggest fans, Paige Blair, says, Paige's poetic lexicon has a black belt in gymnastics. Her poems originate in a space of pageness, and if you've ever been invited to that private place in real life, you know it's one, like her poems are, littered with muskegee ducks, mangled deer, and lizards she can rescue from the library. Paige carries around honey in a vial for bees suffering from diabetes. In the world, her poems are vital to our undiagnosed collective condition on the page. They serve as ailments to insincerity. The control of her poems administer an uncomfortable hug. Another genuinely enthusiastic fan, Kava Akbar, says, amid a wash of ectoplasmic generality in so much of contemporary poetry, Paige's poems zoom into their subjects with startling exactness. Knots in the handkerchief pulled from a magician's throat, barcodes used to conceal a fruit's bruises, the watermelon seed between a child's teeth. Her great gift is the ability to find angles that make the horrible approachable, the terrifying sweet. Her poems make me forget how afraid I'm supposed to be, the way an ultra-magnified electron microscope photo of a spider's fuzzy legs makes you forget its fangs. And then two more and we'll be finished. And someone who knows Paige longer than all three of us combined, Milhouse, all the way from Springfield, has had an achingly long crush on Paige, which gets more awkward as she grows older and he somehow can't. He says, I don't like having to read poetry, but Paige makes it cool. What's more exciting than Mrs. Simpson's cupcakes right out of the oven? Blood in the cupcakes. Is the blood radioactive? I trade Bart's soul back for some of that. In a more substantial blurb, Lisa Simpson went on and on about the power structure of Springfield and how Paige's poems confront the cruelty of such a universe by using language so elegant and haunting that Paige must have been reading Sylvia Plath from an early age, just like herself. Lady Lazarus has to be woven in the fabric of Paige's creative unconscious, Lisa says, adding that the Paige poem is now woven into your own creative unconscious, which sort of balances out the psychological damage inflicted by Lisa's overwhelmingly patriarchal landscape. She adds finally, it's as if she discovered the truth and beauty principle. Paige came to FSU from the University of South Florida where she earned a BA in English with an emphasis in creative writing. As an arguably precocious undergrad, she had 16 poems published, and her recent poems have appeared or are forthcoming in Columbia Poetry Review, the New Orleans Review, the Blue Earth Review, among others. She served for a year as Southeast Review's program manager and is now an assistant editor for poetry at Narrative Magazine. If you're up early enough, you might find her in coffee shops where she doesn't miss a morning of writing poetry beautiful and true enough to make you believe in it like I do. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Paige Lewis.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kelly, and thank you for letting everyone know that I'm not psychotic. That was nice. Like, as long as they know that leaving, it'll be a good night. So thank y'all for coming here. There's a lot of you out there. I didn't expect to be able to see all of your faces. I'm not sure if that makes it better or not, that you're not all just a blur, but I've got a few recent poems and I'll just get right into them. So the first one is called Reasons to Wake You. To tell you that the wintering cedar waxwing is able to fit through the growing hole in your roof. That the stars seem secure tonight, not one willing to move, willing to risk the cold. That flowers here are lethal, and bees, desperate for sweet, suck shells from candy. That their honey is now blue and thick and useless. That barcodes are used to conceal a fruit's bruises. That the response to, "May the Lord be with you," has been changed to avoid acknowledging the body. I need to tell you about creatures heaved up from deep ocean valleys to the shallows where their organs burst, unable to take the weight of air. About coming so close to the surface but never breaching. About learning light from the ache of a body's failure. Can I tell you I feel it? Feel the fading, the sweet silk pine smell of darkness? Can I wake you to say that when I was young, I thought the moon came out at midday just for me? Thanks. So the next poem I'm going to read is called This Side Up, and I have Alex Quinlan to thank for the title of this poem, because the original title was garbage, and he stepped in with his amazing titling abilities. And what I'm really trying to say is if you don't like the title, it's Alex's fault. So This Side Up. For your purposes, the machine inside is a woman. She has been programmed to carry but never initiate conversation. She comes equipped with endless knowledge, from gapping spark plugs to the Mashisha's lifted kick, and can recite Jesus's 46 parables or perform the 64 positions of the Kama Sutra depending on your wants. If you decide her worldly grasp surpasses your own, press the red button on your remote, batteries included, to narrow her understanding and create sincere reverence when you locate the clustered seven sisters, searing blue and forever fleeing Orion. She will repeat Pleiades in her sleep, guaranteed to feel pain as small as pinpricks. Her eyelashes are supplied with mascara. Their vats last 1 year or 200 crying jags, whichever comes first. If she becomes clumsy and bumps beet jars off counters, call the number listed on her wrist and an updated model will be delivered before the juice stains tile. Our company boasts a lifetime warranty that begins as soon as you break the vacuum seal and hear her first hello. Her name is Alicia, but it doesn't have to be. Thanks. Can everyone hear me? Okay. Sound good? Awesome. So this next poem is called On the First Ferris Wheel, 1893. And I doubt that any of y'all need me to explain what a Ferris wheel looks like. But you should know that the first one was intended to make the Eiffel Tower look like a chump. So it had really giant cars on it that would hold about 60 people. And so this poem takes place in one of those cars when one of the riders decides he does not like being lifted into the air by a giant wheel. Okay. On the First Ferris Wheel, 1893. A man riding thinks, please let these windows be paintings. Let the floor trembling be only knees, be an earthquake, anything. This is the first time he has craved the dirt. He becomes charged, a bull. He dents the rails, wants out, even if out means air. His fellow riders are not bulls. They only came to wave, revolving over head-raised strangers. They ask if it would be safer to stand centered or to line the edges. One of the women unzips her skirt, chases after his rush, all elbows, stiff shoulders. She wraps her cotton tight around his eyes, and she becomes his mother. And it's his birthday, warm candlelight pricking through blindfold. He stops spinning. Dizzy, he doesn't feel the pin, his tail. There's so much silence, he can't remember if they already sang or if everyone is waiting on him, dry mouths open. So this next poem, I wrote about the month of August, and since most of October and September are between us and August, I can let you know that August is a terrible, terrible month, and the only reason it's even in this poem is to describe how gross it is. And if there are any fans of August out there, I want to let you know that he doesn't care about you at all. So this is called Open Your Windows in Welcome. August is split-shinned lurching into your front yard. It laps at the dog's water and leaves a layer of slime that shines metallic, and you know the bowl will never rinse right. It pushes mangled birds and browning foxglove through the mail slot. You don't need this. You already learned the smells of flowers from shower gels. Yet the birds cave into you. You wonder, how careless were their mothers? August comes in with the landlord, who pushes the heaping mulch from your doorway to survey the black spots on the ceiling, and he insists that mold is nothing to cry about. Inside, August spreads wide, dips its fingers down your milk glass, bites holes into bedsheets. It doesn't watch the landlord leave, but crouches with its back to the wall and with eyes only for you. Thanks. This next poem is called These Bodies, Threatened by All We Build. And it's basically about how much it sucks when you stub your toe or hit your head and you're just full of all this rage and pain, and someone gets right in your face to ask if you're... I trip, and my palm catches the corner of your record. No blood, but thin bones shift, and you bend down, brick that spiraled from a half-finished fifth floor. A shelter for stray dogs. And maybe it wasn't the fire that killed him. Are you okay? And I think about that fox hanging, because the fences will stay up. No one is taking down. On distance. It's nothing. My breasts and around your neck feels no heavier. 'Tis no way to know how far it fell, and so it never fell at all. I promise he won't come looking for it. Are you willing? Light live through websites. What I mean is, this one light can reach as many people as the sun, and you only have to lean for being such rad hosts. Yeah! Alex tonight, whose poetry never fails to blow me away. And it sucks to see your faces. I've decided I don't like it so much. But thanks for being there, and thanks for not, like, tipping for a week until the rope of knotted silk ends and she, age soaked and shivering. For a moment, her partial chandelier with its candles still lit. I watch for you, nothing in, or because she takes everything out, but I am grateful for her who stands atop glow-in-the-dark rocks. For the payphone, spring, I am grateful, though I'm the last one in the audience, and I have seen enough, shows me her wisdom teeth nestled within a small jar among...